I am really, you know, you heard me, some of you heard me already, and I'm a COPD researcher. But my very first beginning was in asthma. And I am still on the British Thoracic Society Sine Asthma Guidelines Group. And I've done that now for nearly 20 years. Asthma must not be forgotten. I think we are in a real, we have a real danger in the respiratory world for forgetting asthma. COPD has been nothing 25 years ago and is now the biggest cited disease with the most number of publications. But asthma is the most, in airways disease, is the most common airways disease in the world. And we must not forget that. Many times when I speak to my primary care colleagues about asthma, they say, but it's cured, it's finished, it's not a problem. That is not true. And it's very important that we address asthma very clearly and we maintain a great control and grip of asthma, and I'll explain why in a moment. Asthma is a key issue. Our patients suffer from debilitating illness. They themselves have a poor perception of asthma control. I'm going to show you how we have a poor understanding of asthma control. That there is enormous healthcare and social costs which go with asthma, which over and above other things. We know people have persistent symptoms. They have low expectations of their disease. They have attacks of asthma. And these asthma attacks kill, as well as causing morbidity, but they kill people. They cause hospitalization. Very important that asthma population have time off work and time off school. And as I've said, there is a mortality. So what do we want to do with asthma? What are we trying to do? This is from the GINA guidelines. We are kind in Britain, we're kind of aligned with GINA, but not quite the same. But there are two types of things we're trying to do. One is to evolve control of risk to stop exacerbations, anti-inflammatory control. And the other one is symptom control, to make the people feel better. And there's very clear evidence that actually if you do control symptoms, you reduce attacks, you make people feel that you improve their quality of life, and you prevent deterioration in lung function, which is very, very reassuring. But let's ask what the patients think. David Price, who you heard yesterday speak here, did a fantastic study a long time ago now, 15 years ago now, which asked patients, what do they want? What do our patients want? Our patients don't want bad asthma days. They don't want to be taking their medications. They don't want to have restrictions from their life because of breathlessness, because of wheeze, because of not being able to exercise. Do you know, I have very, very few patients that come to me and say, oh, Dr. Russell, my asthma's not very good today because my peak flow is only 50 or my variability is 100. They don't care about peak flow. They care about how they feel, and that's really important. I do use peak flow sometimes to monitor control and to monitor exacerbations, but it's not always essential. It's really important to know what control is, and what do we define as control. We define, should define control, and this is well controlled, this is perfect control, this is well controlled disease, no symptoms, no wakening, no use of reliever, and no problems with activity. Can you say that your patients have none of those? It's a real challenge, and I think we should always challenge our patients about that too. Very, very important. This is a scary comparison that I want to make for you. It can be done better. In the United Kingdom, Britain, we are not in any way perfect with asthma control. And I'll show you more of that data. We have 80 asthma deaths per million of population. In Finland, 2 years ago, they had 7 deaths, 7 in total. Two asthma deaths per million population. We can do better, and that's about a holistic approach with the right treatments, the right diagnosis, the right education. It's very important. So what about you guys? What's going on in the Gulf, the Middle East? Now, the AIR study, Asthma in Real Life, has been done in Britain and in Europe, AIRE, and now in the Gulf. If you look at how do we think we're doing with control, do you know what? We think we're doing, you think you're doing really well. 60% well controlled, according to the GINA guidelines. That's with people's perspective. That's when they ask, how do you think you're doing? But if you look at out of control and break it down, it doesn't work like that. Less than 50% of people are actually well controlled. So we don't have the right perception of this disease. Are there effects of asthma? I think this is quite really interesting when you break it down. Interesting, in Lebanon, I mean, it's very busy, the yellow slides are Lebanon. There are over 60% of children with asthma having to have time off school, either because of their disease or because of the parents' disease, I would guess. High levels of hospitalization, high levels of attendance in A&E, in Kuwait, for example. Every country has different issues with pollution, with sand and dust, I've been told about, which is very important. So it is different. But remember, there is a lot of disease out there. When we look at how we think we're controlled, do we think we have good control? This is a Canadian study, a telephone study. They looked at the physicians and GPs and specialist GPs and patients' assessment of their asthma. 97% of patients thought they were well controlled. GPs, 88% thought their patients were well controlled. Secondary care, 90% well controlled. But when you actually look at that in some kind of objective measure, less than 50% are well controlled. And many, many studies have shown that now time and time again, around 50% of every stage of disease, stage 2, stage 3, stage 4. So it's not about severity of illness, it's just in general, 50% are not well controlled. So why are they not well controlled? What is wrong? Well, when I used to work in a difficult asthma clinic, and the thing we try and do right, first of all, is put the right diagnosis. We already discussed a little bit diagnosis this morning about between asthma and COPD. Are we choosing the right inhaler? Do we check the technique? Did the patient take the drugs? Are they still smoking? Do they have uncontrolled upper airways disease, which is very, very difficult? I don't believe two things. I do not believe that you can control asthma if you have uncontrolled rhinosinusitis, and I also don't believe you can control asthma if you've got uncontrolled reflux disease. Think about those things. Are they deliberately not taking their medication, or is there a problem with it? Do people vary? Yes, of course they do. Are we treating them on the correct disease? The living and breathing study was done by a good friend of mine, John Hockney, and John's a GP from Glasgow. He's also the director of respiratory medicine for Scotland now. And he challenged people and said, you know, how do you feel your asthma is? And they all said, oh, again, 60% said, yeah, I was fine, I was doing fine. But when they were shown the GINA guidelines, shown, you know, I should be feeling better, half of them said, my treatment doesn't do that. I'm not good enough. Let me show you some more evidence. This is worth looking at if you want to really look at how to manage asthma well. We've just published, not I haven't, this Mark Levy, another GP from South London. Mark is a fantastic photographer, first thing of all. And so you look at his website, he's got the most beautiful photographs of wildlife, of animals. He's from South Africa. But he's also an expert at asthma death. And he was chosen to run our national review of asthma deaths, which is run by a Royal College of Physicians. And they took deaths. They took set a panel up of volunteer assessors who looked at 6 to 10 cases per panel, who looked at the cases in great detail of why the patient died, what had happened in the full case history for the years before their death. They found overall that 195 out of 276 did die of asthma, and we made over 1,000 recommendations. In the patients who died, there were major factors that were avoidable in over 60%. And it's a fantastic set of data to read and to have a look at. And it's actually very, very sad indeed in some ways. A couple of highlights for you, or lowlights, I should say, maybe. 58% of those people who died were labeled as having mild or moderate asthma. They're not severe asthmatics. They're not stage 4 asthmatics. They're not people on omalizumab and oral steroids. These were people on basic inhaled corticosteroids. So, were we actually underdefined? Did we think these people, we were downgrading them? Were they not more severe than they thought we thought they were? 33% had no details in their records of asthma diagnosis. 43% had no asthma review in 12 months. 20% had no assessment of asthma control, either with peak flow or with lung function or with asthma control questionnaire. Only 23% had personal action plans. And we know personal action plans reduce mortality, no question. And 57% were not of death. These are people dying, were not under specialist care. This is a very scary target. If you looked at who's prescribing SABRs and how many were prescribed to the people that died, 40% were receiving more than 12 SABRs in the year before they died. Six people, more than 50. That is not good control and should be a huge red flag of mortality in asthma. Let me tell you about this case. This is a case that they have on their website. As a lady with late onset asthma, the diagnosis was confirmed late, and she'd had many, many months of intermittent salbutamol, 28% reversibility on spirometry. She had asthma. I had a patient in hospital a month ago that I had sent to ITU within 4 hours of arrival who had been treated 5 times with oral steroids and just with short-acting beta agonists for 3 months by the GP. This patient was given low dose of inhaled steroids. She was reviewed by the practice nurse. She was documented to be waking at night. She had daytime symptoms. Asthma was affecting her. So the control was bad. In the last 12 months, she'd used 16 inhalers of salbutamol and one steroid. She wasn't taking the steroid, not just one. The nurse said, oh, you must see the doctor. The patient died before the appointment was ever made. Now, in each of these stages, you can see there were missed opportunities to intervene, to actually save this person's life. And on the website of the NRAD, there are 4 or 5 clear case histories like this. Okay, can we get best control? Can we really achieve what Gina is asking us to do? The answer is yes. How? We make the correct diagnosis. We educate the patients properly. We have a zero tolerance for symptoms. I think it's really important to say we do not accept disease as it is, and you must be structured with your consultation as much as possible. If I want a quiet clinic, and I have an asthma clinic, and I want an easy afternoon, patients will come to me and I'll say, how's your asthma? And they'll look at me and smile and they'll say, fine, doctor. And I'll say, okay, very good, carry on, off you go. No, we don't do that. We structure things. How many times have you woken in the last week because of asthma? Do you need your inhaler as much as soon as you awake? How many times are you using rescue therapy? Are you getting symptoms in the day? All are very, very important. And I also challenge my patients. Do you know, I don't want you to have symptoms. I don't want you to have any of these attacks. I'm challenging you that we can really, really do better. Now, this talks about moving things forward a little bit as well as the past. So I've challenged you here about challenging about control, about what is can be achieved and how we achieve it. The cornerstone of treatment is inhaled steroids. There is no question about this whatsoever. Steroids are the most important treatment in asthma. This is a study we did at the Brompton Hospital under Peter Barnes, looking at moderate asthmatics, which very clearly showed that actually at low doses of steroids, medium doses of steroids, shall we say, 400 micrograms a day of budesonide given through a turbohaler, you can achieve extremely good control of symptoms, of lung function, of nitric oxide as a measure of airway inflammation. Very, very good control achieved at very mild levels of steroids. So we don't need lots of steroid. And the evidence for steroids is very clear, that if you're an asthmatic and you take steroids regularly, you will be okay. It's those that don't do it have problems. So it's really important to get this as a number one thing in people's minds. So why do people not take treatment? Well, I've talked about inhalers already this morning. The inhalers sometimes are bad. Method of administration can be a problem. We sometimes give complex regimes. We give inhalers, we give 3 different types of inhalers, which is completely bonkers. Patients come in with bags of inhalers and say, which ones do I use when? We have dosing regimes, which are frequent, which is a problem. Patients are afraid of side effects. When I talk about this, sometimes I have a picture of a muscle man, a bodybuilder, because patients think, if I take inhaled steroids, they're going to turn into a muscle man. Mothers are afraid for their children if they take steroids, that what's going to happen? Are they going to be stunted growth? Are they going to have osteoporosis? Bad asthma is much, much worse for stunted growth than taking inhaled steroids. There is a lack of understanding of asthma. patients need to learn and understand what asthma is, and they also need to understand what their treatments are for, what their treatments do. Some people forget their medications. Some people are in denial about their disease and so don't take their medications. Some people like to be sick, which is a problem. But often they have problems because you use multiple medications, which are complicated to do. So what have we got in asthma? We have steroids. Steroids are the most important and efficacious anti-inflammatory therapy in asthma. We've got to improve that lung function and reduce attacks, absolutely, by treating that airway inflammation. But also we reduce symptoms by reducing bronchoconstriction, by bronchodilating. So treating and preventing with bronchodilators is very important as well. This, I'm going to show you a brief talk you through, very briefly, a quick case, which is a real patient of mine. This is a patient of 63 who'd had asthma for 40 years. Funnily enough, he'd been diagnosed with COPD as well. He didn't have COPD. He's got asthma. When you take a story, he had asthma that came on in his 20s. He had his last attack 25 years ago, and people forget that. He manages it. He deals with his disease. He muddles on. He pushes on, and he stays up at night sometimes with things. When I asked him how he was, he said he was fine. But he's not fine. He's 63. He walks 200 yards and gets puffed out. That is not fine. When I examined his chest, he had a wheeze in his chest. His lung function, FEV and spirometry, is very important in asthma. You know this, it's very important, but trying to get secondary care to understand that is difficult. Spirometry is important. His FEV1 was 65%. Bad, not good at all. But his nitric oxide was 12, meaning his airway inflammation, hopefully, was good. And he was taking his steroids, so that's a good marker of airways control. He was taking Seretide, Fluticasone, Salmeterol combination, 250 micrograms BD, so decent dose of steroid. So what was I going to do? I was going to try something else. Was I going to put him on Montelukast? Was I going to put him on Theophylline? Was I going to give him azithromycin, which is a very trendy treatment at the moment? Actually, I chose to put him on Spirorespimat because he fit the bill very nicely for somebody with relatively fixed long-term airways obstruction, and I saw him a month later. His FEV1 had gone up 15%. 78% now. He had no wheeze in his chest and he felt better. So he needed more bronchodilatation. It's very important. So for that patient, the anticholinergic filled the gap for him. Will it fill the gap for everybody? Almost certainly not. But is it an important extra weapon we have now for asthma? Yes. I want to reiterate and emphasize again, there are two arms to treating asthma. There's on the right-hand side over there, there's anti-inflammatory treatment, which requires inhaled steroids, absolutely requires inhaled steroids. And we know from the American experience, who hate steroids, the Americans hate steroids, if you give treatment without steroids on their own, which they did with salmeterol, patients die. So that's a bad thing to do. But you treat with steroids, and you then add long-acting beta agonists, long-acting muscarinic antagonists. They work in combination of ways together, one opening the airway, when the other one unblocking the airway closure, also having effect on mucociliary clearance and mucus production, which is really important in asthma. Tiotropium we know about, it's been around for years now, is a very effective long-acting muscarinic antagonist, which works as at the M1, M2, M3 receptors with very strong binding to the M3 receptor. And the bronchoconstriction is caused by the action of acetylcholine. If you block the acetylcholine at the M3 receptor, it prevents that bronchoconstriction happening. M2 action is weak, allowing a negative feedback loop to carry on, down-regulating the acetylcholine release, which is good, and it blocks the M1 receptors a bit as well, which prevents the ongoing signal. So this is a good anticholinergic. It's a long-acting anticholinergic, and it dissociates, as I said, very slowly with a 24-hour onset of action. This is, I'm sorry, a very wordy slide, but I think it's really important. This is the indication for asthma. This is for tiotropium in asthma. This is where we use Spireva. Spireva is used in the Respimat formulation, and it's now indicated in the American guidelines and the British guidelines as an add-on maintenance bronchodilator in adult patients with asthma treated with a moderate dose of inhaled steroids and LABA, who are having exacerbations or are still symptomatic. So it's important these people are not well controlled at that middle stage. There are there is a huge development study, programs of study, the PRIMO team program, which has developed this story in asthma, the tiotropium asthma study, with a large body of evidence behind it, which shows now how we should use this medication, both in adults and in children. And it is ongoing. I was lucky enough, I was one of the investigators in the TINA study, which was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2012. If we look at the GINA guidelines, where we might be therefore using tiotropium, it will be in step 3, step 4, step 5. Generally in step 4, in the patients who are on high dose, moderate to high dose ICS plus LABA, you have choices. And one of the choices you'd make there is, do you use tiotropium, do you maybe try montelukast, or do you add in a theophylline? I certainly would say, depending on what's going on, you choose the right drug for the right patient, and if you need bronchodilators, the bronchodilator you're going to choose is going to be tiotropium. It's worth also saying that right now we are using this in America, in Europe, in Chile, Ecuador, Colombia, and it's being looked at elsewhere as well. So it is now being used. It's not quite ready here, but it's going to be used. It's going to come out. And I'm sure some of you are already trying it. So let's look at some of the data. Published in JACI, the General Allergy and Clinical Immunology, by Ed Bateman from South Africa, looking at lung function. And showing very straightforwardly that actually if you look at peak flow response in moderate asthmatics over 16 weeks, tiotropium is equivalent to salmeterol. If you look at what happens when you add tiotropium to ICS and LABA, you can see very nicely that actually there is a very clear lung function benefit with the adding in of the LAMA to the patients on LABA ICS, and that translates also into peak flow benefits. So we can summarize by saying in moderate asthmatics or symptomatic, in spite of steroid treatment, tiotropium's response is as good as salmeterol. And in those people already on LABA ICS combinations, the additionally gives you further. Am I surprised? Not at all, because it's a bronchodilator and we can want to get more bronchodilatation for these people. If we look a little bit further, and this is the important, one of the big important studies, and the New England Journal of Medicine study, which looked at tiotropium respimat versus placebo respimat on top of standard therapy, and I'll show you those in a moment. They're real life studies, the kind of patients we're interested in looking at. What actually happens? We've got nearly 1,000 people followed up for a year. They were on high doses of steroids plus LABA. They were still symptomatic. Three endpoints, peak flow, FEV1, FEV1 trough after 24 weeks to make sure there's no tachyphylaxis, and then time to exacerbation. Is there an exacerbation signal? Do these drugs improve exacerbation outcome? The inclusion criteria were people with asthma, less than 40 years old. They did not have COPD. They were diagnosed asthma at least 5 years before. It's asthma diagnosed age of less than 40. They were elderly as well, but they were diagnosed asthma five years at least. They were never smokers or ex-smokers with less than 10 pack year history, so they'd not really smoked. They were symptomatic. They were uncontrolled in spite of being on moderate to high dose of inhaled steroids and LABA. It was mandatory they were on greater than 800 micrograms of budesonide. So they were difficult to recruit, actually. And I only managed to put, I think, 4 patients into the study. They had persistent obstruction. Their spirometry was reduced. These were not up to normal some of the times. And they'd had one attack and exacerbation in the year. It's very important to look at their baseline medication. You can see that they actually were all on steroids, either inhaled steroids or inhaled steroids and some oral steroids. They were nearly all, 98%, on long-acting beta agonists. And they were also on a group of other medications, including mucolytics, theophylline, and even omalizumab. So they were very indicative of the severe asthma phenotype. These were the type of people we'd expect to see. So what happens in two matched studies that when you give tiotropium? Again, am I surprised? Absolutely not. We get another 86 mils, 88 mils of lung function, both peak and trough. So sustained bronchodilator action. Clear, very nice. And this is just a graph showing the same figures, showing on top of normal therapy, you get a lung function benefit. It's a bronchodilator, fantastic. And if we look at peak and trough in trial 2, there's a little bit more response. Why was there a bigger response? Because in these people, because they're uncontrolled, there was more variability in the placebo group arm, because the tiotropium did away with the variability, and there was less of a placebo effect in this study versus the other study. We sometimes see that in studies. And again, you can see the same kind of difference between the placebo Respimat SABA-LABA patients versus tiotropium on top of. Okay, what about exacerbations? Exacerbations were defined quite standardly of those that required corticosteroids, oral corticosteroids, or had to have their ordinary systemic steroids at least doubled for 3 days. What actually happened? There was a 21% risk reduction. So a smaller number of people had exacerbations in the tiotropium arm, as opposed to those people who had LABA ICS already. So there was certainly a reduction in attack rates, which we think are important. If you look at the secondary endpoints, asthma worsening, so increasing symptoms, these were defined as one or more asthma symptoms outside of the patient's usual range with a reduction in peak flows, included the severe asthma exacerbation, so picked up more people, caught more people together. There was a 31% reduction in asthma worsenings. It's not a very good word. It's a difficult definition, but patients felt better. If we look at ACQ, asthma control questionnaire, again, there's no question whatsoever that actually there was a significant difference, a significant improvement in asthma control in both studies. So asthma control, there was certainly variability there, as the placebo response was better in this study than in this study, but there certainly was a very strong signal that the ACQ was improved. 68%, this is quite an important slide. Who did respond? How many people got significantly better with asthma ACQ? And it's this last line we need to look at here. The number of people who responded, which is the positives take off the negatives, who responded to the treatment. There was a significant improvement in the people who were on the tiotropium Respimat versus the placebo Respimat, but that is LABA ICSs. So there was a significant improvement in people who responded to the treatment. What about safety outcomes? Was using tiotropium or is using tiotropium in asthma safe? Obviously, a lot of people involved, nearly 900 people involved in the study, a large number of adverse events, as you'd expect, because these were symptomatic asthmatics. And when you look at the asthma event, the events, for the vast majority were asthma exacerbations. And not surprisingly, placebo had more of the asthma exacerbations than the active treatment tiotropium in the Respimat. So that was a very clear signal that actually there was no other safety signals, but actually a very clear signal was, yeah, it works. So to conclude on these studies, tiotropium Respimat added to ICS and LABA improved lung function somewhere between 100 and 150 mils, reduced severe exacerbations, steroid-requiring exacerbations by 21%, and had a 68% more likelihood of improving asthma control. The safety profile from a drug's perspective was the same as placebo. So this drug is safe in asthma, and it seems to work in asthma very, very much. If we look at the whole pattern of asthma then, we have peak and trough FEV1 improved. It's a bronchodilator. It does what it says. Versus placebo, obviously, but also when added on to ICS and LABA as well. It improves very clearly. In the Primotina study, the ACQ responder rate, and it's comparable, as I've already shown you, to salmeterol from a lung function and symptomatic benefit without any steroid issues. Now, how, therefore, should we treat asthma? Where do we go with asthma now? Well, this is my personal view, and I'm very happy to be challenged about some of the things I'm going to say, but in both the British guidelines and in the GINA guidelines, I do not believe in step one. Step one for me does not exist for more than a tiny, tiny period. If you diagnose asthma, you are diagnosing a chronic lung condition which is inflammatory, that needs anti-inflammatory treatment. And so these people should only be uncontrolled for a period to diagnose them. And you know what? The best test for diagnosis is treating them. So you get them better. So you move them into step two straight away. For some people in step two, so you treat them all with low-dose inhaled steroids, no question. For some people in step two, you may want to use leukotriene receptor antagonists. People have got very predominant rhinosinusitis, who've got nasal disease. Some people have got exercise-induced asthma. And I would say that some people have asthma for some periods of the year. Not all year round, but maybe in the pollen period. So in Britain at the moment, we are through the tree pollens with birch and oak pollen, and we're now getting into the grass pollen time. Some people will need it just for that period, but that's very important. And as a reliever, we use Sabbat, of course. I would say if someone is taking their steroid and you have good evidence they're taking their steroid and they're symptomatic, you should very quickly move to a combination inhaler with ICS LABA together. Why? Because it improves control, because it improves outcome, because it reduces mortality, because it increases lung function, because it improves adherence to treatment. And then you should think about what you're doing with the next step, because do you move up the steroids? Do you add in tiotropium? Do you consider theophylline? You've got options then. And it seems obvious to me if people are symptomatic, opening their lungs up further with tiotropium would be an absolutely sensible and safe thing to do. And then when we get to set five, we're into symptom control, we're into best possible outcome, oral steroids, anti-IgE therapies, new therapies, anti-IL-5 therapies, which are coming through as well. Different things you may want to try, and that's going to be in the context of a specialist asthma service. We must make sure clearly when we're moving into oral steroids and things that we get the diagnosis correct with vocal cord dysfunction, with eosinophilia and other things which can mimic asthma. And we are diagnosing more bronchiectasis these days. And then finally, I want to summarize for me the management of asthma. You must treat every single patient as an individual. There's no such thing as the asthmatic. I have an asthmatic patient. This is a patient with their symptoms, with their spectrum of triggers, with their individual problems, which may be food-related, maybe diet-related, maybe allergy-related. It may not be. Maybe reflux-related. You've got to treat them, therefore, with the right drug. That drug has to be chosen to be in the right dose. And most of all, most important of all, that has to be in the right device. Educating the patient about the disease, the drugs they're using, and the devices is absolutely essential. When I started on the BTS Asthma Guidelines group, there was a big, everyone was divided up into different committees. And all the doctors wanted to go on the drug committee, wanted to go in the, where's the evidence on the drug usage? We all want to look at inhaler drugs, and we want to be looking at the drugs. All of the nurses went into the self-management committee. And the outcomes of those groups were very different and very embarrassing. I went on to the diagnosis committee. How do you make a diagnosis of asthma? And we graded the evidence. We came up with recommendations. My committee, who was chaired by John Hocking, I've already mentioned, John Kajal chaired our committee, we came up with one evidence-based recommendation how you diagnose asthma. There is no evidence about how you diagnose asthma, really. It's difficult. Well, it's not difficult, but there's no evidence for it. The nurses on the self-management group came up with four A-grade evidence-based interactions which improve lives, save lives, and make a huge difference to asthma. So self-management plans work absolutely as well. Thank you very much for listening to that today. I hope I've helped you. Again, I want to thank my main sponsors still. And we still have to stop our asthmatic smoking, our COPD patients smoking, but most importantly, our children smoking. Very, very important. And stop these evil tobacco companies. Thank you for listening.